Welcome to this week Quantum Gravity Seminar. This week, our speaker is Stefan Gillen from the University of Sheffield, and he will talk about unitarity and clock dependence in quantum cosmology. As usual, if you want to ask questions, you can use the raise hand feature on Zoom, or you can ask anonymous question using the Google form in the chat. Stefan, you can start wherever you are ready.
Great. Thanks very much. Thanks, Alessia. And yeah, thanks a lot for the invitation, of course. It's always a great pleasure to be able to reconnect a little bit with the group at the Perimeter Institute, even if it's just virtually for now. So I gave a somewhat similar talk in the quantizing time meeting in June. So I apologize if people have seen this other talk, and there will be some overlap because it's about essentially the same results. But that was just a short talk. So even if you've already seen that talk and remember everything, you will see a lot more details here. So we're kind of discussing the problem of time in quantum gravity. And in fact, in the much simpler setting of quantum cosmology, where things are kind of analytically solvable and simple enough so that you can sort of compare different ideas. So I guess the problem of time, I mean, depending on who you ask in quantum gravity, it's either the most fundamental question of all in quantum gravity, or it's some technical discussion that people don't really understand. But I want to connect it here in particular to this notion of unitarity, right? So that's, I think, something that people often maybe argue about or talk about in quantum gravity. What is the notion of unitarity? Should we expect it to be fundamental for the theory? And what does it even mean? And of course, that's going to be something that, again, in the simpler setting of quantum cosmology, you can talk about very concretely because you kind of know what to compute. Basically, I'm going to look at a relatively simple model in quantum cosmology here. And there will be different candidates for a time coordinate. So that's what I mean here by clock dependence. So a degree of freedom in the theory plays the role of a clock, and therefore there's a notion of time evolution. And then one can ask whether this is unitary. And this is a very straightforward question. And it will lead to perhaps somewhat surprising or puzzling answers in this setting. So this is joint work with Lucia Menendez-Pidal. And there are two papers here which have been published, which give you a lot of detail on these results, probably more than you actually want to know about. So the type of clock that I'm interested in here, just to set the scene, is what we would call perhaps a relational clock. And again, this is something that will be very familiar to some people and maybe completely new to some other people in the audience. So this is a discussion that you already have in the classical theory. And the question is really the one here that I'm taking from the title of a paper by Carlo Rovelli, which is what is observable in classical and quantum gravity. And many people have worked on this, I should stress this, including Bianca in particular and many others. So I'm not going to be able to review all the literature here. So I'm just focusing on this one paper as an example. So in that paper, Carlo gives some discussion sort of starting from the foundations of general relativity, focusing on the fact that we have a symmetry of the theory under diffeomorphisms, which means that the labels we attach to space-time coordinates don't have any physical meaning in themselves, right? So in particular, if I work in a coordinate system on a given kind of solution of GR, and then I ask sort of what is the Ricci scalar at a point x0 specified by some coordinates, this is not an observable quantity because it would be not invariant under diffeomorphisms. Perhaps a more kind of physical example for cosmology, which is what we're going to focus on here. If you ask what was the spatial curvature of the universe at t equals zero, again, it's not clear what the answer would be because the question isn't really well posed because it's dependent on a particular coordinate choice. Sort of from a more abstract point of view, you would say that if you are interested in observables, which is what we're going to discuss here, they should be invariant under gauge transformations in general. And we know that the Hamiltonian, the ADM Hamiltonian general relativity includes the generators of gauge transformations. And so if an observable is supposed to be invariant under those, it's supposed to commute with the Hamiltonian. And then you come to the conclusion that in fact, it must be a constant of the motion because of that, right? And again, these are arguments that many people have made in the past. Under and Wald give a very nice discussion in their paper. But then of course you can ask, what is the physical meaning of these quantities if they all have to be constants of motion? Where's the notion of dynamics coming from, right? And that's really the heart of the question. And one very popular way out of this kind of apparent dilemma is to use something that you would call a material reference system. So you are labeling space-time points, not by some arbitrary coordinates, but sort of in a more physical way by using matter fields, right? So you can phrase a question in this kind of more sort of operational way by saying you are not interested in a particular coordinate point, but you're asking what is the matter energy density when a scalar field, for example, in your model had a particular value. And that is then an observable. And in some sense, it's also a constant of motion, right? Because you are, in a sense, you have to trace through the entire evolution history of your solution, and you have to find the point where phi equals phi zero, and that's when you're going to evaluate the matter energy density. So these are these kind of relational clocks, as we call them here, and usually they're matter degrees of freedom, and in some sense that then gives you a notion of observable here. So that's the kind of clock that we're using in this model. Just a bit more on the problem of time. So of course, again, if you come from the classical theory, you might find all of this quite puzzling because of course you can work in coordinates and there's nothing wrong with it. This is of course what we do normally when we deal with classical theory. So here as a simple example, you're looking at a cosmological model of a flat homogeneous isotropic universe, which has a free massless scalar field. So this is the standard type of matter field, the simplest possible matter field that you can have. And the Hamiltonian is of this form that I'm giving here. So you've got, so A is your scale factor and phi is the scalar field. You've got conjugate momenta, PA and P phi. And what's important here is that this whole thing is multiplied by the lapse. And the lapse, of course, is related to your choice of time coordinate. So you can set N equal to 1, for example. This is a canonical choice. And then you can compute time evolution in the standard way by just solving these equations. You have to make sure that your initial data satisfies H equals 0, but then you can solve in this model, it would be very straightforward for you to write down the solution in this gauge where N equals 1, where you have just used proper time as your time coordinate. There's nothing wrong with that in the classical theory, but in the quantum theory, you don't have access to this information. So this is kind of this crucial insight here. If H vanishes, usually you would impose this as an operator equation. That means your state is annihilated by H, but then this time evolution operator is just the identity on this state. So you don't have access to anything that depends on these kind of coordinates T. And so you are forced to go back to these relational clocks. And people often call this sort of a frozen quantum theory. And this is the problem of time, which we could have an entire talk on, but that's not what I'm going to do here. So you can pick one of these internal times, which is, you know, given by a particular one of the degrees of freedom in your theory. So, for example, these reference scalar fields are very, very popular in quantum cosmology, in fact, also in quantum gravity, but other choices are possible. But it depends on the model. So in general, one of the objections is that your clock might not be monotonic everywhere, depending on the dynamics. This degree of freedom might turn around and go backwards, right? And then your notion of time is no longer sort of one-to-one as specified by this clock. So here we're going to look at a system where this is not a problem, but then we have other problems because you know, once you've specified the clock, you need to talk about the inner product of the quantum theory, which has to come from somewhere. You have to define the theory in the sense of whether you require to be unitary, whether you want a probability interpretation. And one of the issues here in particular is there are multiple candidate clocks. So one could start from different starting points by using one of the clocks, and it's not clear whether the theory is defined with respect to different clocks are equivalent. So in fact, it's kind of, this is sort of the embarrassment of riches in some sense, where you have different theories, which you could define in this way, and they're not obviously equivalent. Of course, again, these issues have been discussed for decades by many, many people, and people have come up with clever techniques to work around some of these issues. And one very popular approach is Dirac quantization, where you specify a kinematical inner product before, in some sense, fixing the clock. And then you have this group averaging procedure to construct a physical inner product. This is very popular in this community. And in fact, here, there's been a lot of very interesting recent work, in particular, these two papers by Hearn, Smith, and Locke, where they show that, in fact, for many systems, one can show that the theories defined for different clocks are actually equivalent. So this is, of course, very, very, very interesting. But here we will see an example, of course, where this does not hold. So then these questions are still very open. So now after these remarks, let me introduce the model finally. So it's a very simple cosmological model. And I'm going to give you all the mathematical details. And I hope it's kind of clear what this model represents. So again, we're working cosmology. So we are assuming in the very simplest approximation to cosmology, the universe is homogeneous, isotropic, and spatially flat. So this is the kind of metric you can use to describe this situation. So H is just a flat metric in your favorite coordinate system for these x's. Then you have the scale factor here, A of tau, and then you have N of tau, which is your lapse function. The reason why I'm using tau is that this is supposed to be a general choice of time coordinate, because I haven't yet fixed the lapse function, right? So I don't know what this time coordinate represents. This is the general form for the metric. And then we have two matter fields. So one is, again, this free massless scalar that I already used before in the even more basic example, and which is a very common type of matter to add in quantum cosmology, not particularly realistic perhaps, but it's very nice as a clock, which is why people like to have this. And then there's also a perfect fluid. Again, something that's very common in cosmology. Here, for the purposes of this model, all you need to know is that this perfect fluid can be characterized by an energy density, rho, which is again just a function of time because everything is homogeneous. And it has an equation of state parameter, W, which basically gives you a continuity equation. So for example, you could model dust by choosing W equals zero. Again, dust is very popular in quantum cosmology. You could also model dark energy in this way by choosing minus one as your equation of state parameter. Or there are many other options here, of course, depending on the model. The point is that this W then leads you to a conserved quantity. So basically, the energy density rho multiplied by a particular power of the scale factor, that is a constant of motion, right? So that's just the continuity equation from cosmology. And we call this constant M here. You can think of it as a conserved momentum, or in fact, a type of energy that is conserved. So that's a useful thing to keep in mind. So for example, for dust, this is just A cubed, right? So you have rho times A cubed is constant, which makes sense because rho is kind of diluted with the expansion of the universe, like one over A cubed. In the case where you have dark energy, you see that this A term just drops out and rho itself is a constant, which again makes sense because that's basically what the cosmological constant is. It's just a constant energy density. But here, the point is that you can rephrase all of this just in terms of this quantity M. So we're not going to forget about rho now. We're just going to use this M. And then you can do the usual sort of mini superspace reduction, and you come up with an action for this theory, which I'm giving you here. So I've added a boundary term, which I guess is the Gibbons-Hawking York boundary term in the usual way. And then I have this action here. So the dynamical variables here are A, the scale factor, phi, the scalar field, M is this conserved quantity for the perfect fluid, chi is Lagrange multiplier, and N is the lapse. And chi only has this role here of basically enforcing that M is a constant of motion. And you always have this V0, which comes from integrating over space, which we're essentially going to ignore in the following. So that's the action. And now you derive the Hamiltonian in the usual way. But the interesting thing here is that basically you can bring this Hamiltonian to a canonical form for any choice of W. So I told you that W was essentially arbitrary. It just had to be less than one. And in fact, you can really achieve this kind of canonical form, which I'm just going to show you here. So this is a bit of a mathematical detail still, which is not going to be too important, but just to show you how you obtain this canonical form. So from the scale factor A, we go to this variable V, which is a power of A. So this depends on this W here. And this is the canonical momentum. So pi A was the conjugate momentum to A, and then pi V is the conjugate momentum to V. So this transformation is just a canonical transformation, basically. You have to rescale the scalar field variables, and you also have to rescale this M by just absorbing this kind of V0 factor that we don't really want to have. And you also have to redefine the laps in this way. And you end up, after all these steps, you end up with this kind of canonical form of the Hamiltonian. So this is now very, very simple, right? So you have kind of three canonical pairs of variables. V, again, is this here. This is a power of the scale factor. So this is basically the metric degree of freedom, which has a canonical momentum. Phi is your scalar field, which has a canonical momentum. And T and lambda represent the perfect fluid, right? So lambda is, again, this conserved quantity that I told you about before. It's kind of called little lambda for a reason, in the sense that, you know, if you have this dark energy interpretation of your perfect fluid, that would be the cosmological constant. But if it's not, if you don't think of it as dark energy, it's just the conserved quantity you have in your perfect fluid. And it has a conjugate variable T here, which comes from this Lagrange multiplier that we had before. An important point is that we always use the assumption that the scale factor is positive definite. So we don't allow negative A or negative B.
So there is a question by Bianca.
So you do get the little t conjugated to lambda, which, as you say, is sometimes a cosmological constant. Mm-hmm. And that reminds me of unimodular gravity.
Yes.
So it's basically related to that.
Yes, very much so. Yes, thank you. Very good question. Yeah, I should have said that before. So these perfect fluid actions, I mean, I think that's also in the paper that we recently wrote. It's the same discussion, right? You always have these perfect fluid actions, and the equation of state is arbitrary. But if you set the equation of state parameter to -1, you have basically a cosmological constant which appears as an integration constant, which is then the same as unimodular gravity. So in fact, for W equals -1, you can derive the same Lagrangian that I have here from a so-called parameterized form of unimodular gravity, and you get the same answer.
And in this case, like, the little t would be the time proposed by Wald and Unruh or something.
Yes, I'll come to that in 1 minute. That's just the last sentence on this slide, yes. Mm-hmm. That's right. It's perfectly consistent. If you're very happy with unimodular gravity and having a dark energy component here, then you can just forget about the fact that this can also be dust or radiation or whatever. So this is, you can see this as more of a distraction, and you can just work in unimodular gravity if you want. And that would be a perfectly consistent interpretation. Does that make sense?
No.
Good. Okay, so right. So once we're in this canonical form here, so just some points here to remember. So this is linear in this little lambda. This is just, again, coming from the perfect fluid. This always enters linearly, but it's quadratic in the other two momenta here, pi v and pi phi, with a minus sign as usual for the kind of conformal degree of freedom in the metric. And it's multiplied by this rescaled lapse. So now it's clear that you can choose different gauges, of course, but if you choose n tilde equal to 1, then of course this Hamiltonian constraint is very simple. It's these quadratic terms plus lambda equals 0. So lambda really then just enters linearly in your Hamiltonian. the equation of motion in this gauge for this t variable is dt over d tau equals 1. So this is really the gauge in which t is then this, in some sense, preferred time coordinate. And indeed, if w is minus 1, as Bianca already said, this would be unimodular gauge. So in this is the sense in which unimodular gravity comes into this more general framework. But the point is that basically any other choice of perfect fluid also has a preferred time variable in some sense. So whatever w is, there's always going to be kind of this preferred gauge in which basically this t variable really just becomes your time coordinate. And for example, for radiation, this is conformal time. And for dust, it's just proper time, as you might be familiar with if you've read some of these papers on dust and quantum cosmology. So that's something very important to keep in mind. But of course, the theory in this sense still has the general reparametrization invariance in the sense that I could, of course, work in a different gauge. So that's the classical theory. Are there any more questions about the definition of this theory? If not, I'm going to show you the solutions. I guess there are no questions, so I'll carry on for now. So you can now plot the solutions, and we are going to use all these different variables as clocks, as I already said. So basically, there are three candidates here for clocks, right? T is a very natural candidate for clock because of what I already said. It's extremely simple in this particular gauge. It's kind of appears to be a preferred time coordinate. Phi is a good clock, because massless scalar fields evolve monotonically, so they are good clocks. And V is also a very popular clock in quantum cosmology. V only has a problem if the universe recollapses, right? Then it has this turnaround property, but if the universe is just expanding or just contracting, then V is also a good clock. So these are the three clocks that we're going to use. So that's kind of what I already said. T and phi evolve monotonically. You have to exclude this degenerate case, of course, where the scalar field is just constant. And if you take V as a clock, then one of the cases is problematic in some sense, or locally problematic, which is the case of negative lambda, which you can think of as negative cosmological constant if you wish, and there the universe has a recollapse. But if lambda is zero or positive, then V would be monotonic. So here you see the solutions V of T with respect to this T time. So the solid line, this is positive lambda, the dashed line is just here, this is the negative lambda case, and then dotted is the zero lambda case. So the important thing to take away here is that, I mean, this will not be surprising at all if you know anything about cosmology, but all these solutions have a big bang and a big crunch singularity, right? So V goes to zero here. So for example, if you look at the positive lambda universe, this is just a universe which would start at the Big Bang here and just expands forever. Or here, this is the contracting branch, the universe ends in a big crunch. And yeah, the negative lambda case has a turnaround and recollapse, but it also has a Big Bang and a big crunch singularity. Is there a question?
Yes, Manu.
Yes, I think I missed something. Means when you say that phi and t are monotonic, with respect to what parameter? Means we don't have a prior time in the picture, right? So they're monotonic with respect to what?
With respect to any time coordinate that you can define in one of the usual gauges. So, right. So I mean, if something is monotonically increasing, that would be true even if I redefine the time coordinate in a monotonic way, if that makes sense. So I could derive these solutions. What I'm trying to say is that you could derive these solutions in any gauge that you want. And if that's a well-defined gauge, then the statement will be true and it will evolve monotonically.
So it's not like maybe you evolve T with respect to phi and it's still monotonic or something like that. It's just some other, any coordinate that we choose, they just turn out to be monotonic, say in classical case.
For example, compared to proper time. Yeah, or to conformal time. If there's a time coordinate that you like, which maybe works well for your calculations, you can pick that and you will find that T and phi are monotonic.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But of course, it's true that phi of T, I mean, this is the right-hand side of this plot here. This is, of course, also a monotonic function because you're comparing two things which are mm-hmm. clocks to each other. So of course, then the statement is still true that this is a monotonic relation.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question. Great. So yeah, the right-hand side shows you the scalar field phi as a function of t. And you see here why we call these things singularities. This is because the scalar field phi diverges here, right? So here, for example, you have this a solid line, the universe contracts, it ends in a big crunch. And here the scalar blows up, goes to infinity. Same here, the Big Bang goes to minus infinity and so on, right? So this is, again, not surprising, but this is very important because if you now want to use phi as a clock, it means that this phi clock has a funny behavior, which is that at the singularity, it kind of runs away to infinity, right? Either to plus or to minus infinity. Whereas the other limit is very different. So if the universe expands forever, v goes to infinity. But for example, here for this solid line, you see that phi actually settles down to a constant. So in that sense, it's a very unusual clock, which sort of as the universe expands, just becomes slower and slower and settles to a constant. But it's still a monotonic function here, which is kind of what I'm going to show you now. So these are the solutions in phi time, right? So I can use phi as a clock. So then I have the quantities v of phi and t of phi that I might be interested in. And again, I have these three cases here. So these look very different, of course, to the functions that I had before. As you would expect, this is something that's familiar from classical GR. Of course, if you use a different time coordinate, then things can look very different. The important point here is that if lambda is positive, then v goes to infinity at some finite time with respect to this phi clock, right? So at this point here, phi equals zero, actually the volume diverges. Whereas the singularities that I mentioned before, the Big Bang and the Big Crunch, they are now pushed to minus and plus infinity. So they're always going to be out here at infinity and out here at infinity. So the T clock again, it's kind of the inverse of the relation on the previous slide. The takeaway point here is that the explicit form of the cosmological solutions highly depends on the choice of clock. And this is going to be important for the quantum theory. And here the point is, so what's kind of special about this model is that sort of you have these different clocks available to you as kind of physical degrees of freedom. So you can choose them as relational clocks and you can actually compare between them. So that's what we're going to do next. So now we have three different quantum theories, as I already said, with these three different clocks. So let me just tell you in a bit of detail how we define these quantum theories. So the Hamiltonian constraint is the same that I derived before. So just to make that clear, that the Hamiltonian is the Laplace function times the constraint, right? So whatever's inside the brackets is a constraint that has to vanish, as is always the case in these kind of gravitational systems. So that's what I mean by this wiggly line zero notation. This is from Dirac. And here we just introduce kind of a notation for this, where basically these first two terms, which are quadratic in the momenta, these are written in this form, GAB pi A pi B, where basically G is thought of as a metric on a two-dimensional configuration space. And in fact, this metric is flat. And this part of the configuration space, which is sort of parameterized by this V and this phi variable, is the Rindler wedge. So it's not the whole of Minkowski space, but it's only the Rindler wedge. And again, it's because V is positive, right? This volume variable is, we assume it has to be positive. So you don't get all of Minkowski space. You just get this wedge. Lambda is just there. It's kind of this linear piece. So what we do to quantize, of course, here, there are always some choices about sort of operator ordering and ambiguities and so on. So the way we resolve these is basically to require that this first part is quantized in such a way that you could change coordinates. So it's kind of, if you have this geometric picture that this is a metric on the Rindler wedge, you define the natural object that would be invariant under kind of coordinate changes on this Rindler wedge. And this is of course a choice, but it seems very kind of natural from this interpretation. And if you do this, you have this kind of box operator. I'm leaving in powers of h bar here just to be more explicit. And this second piece, that's just linear in a momentum. So we use this usual kind of momentum operator. So then we have this kind of wave function here, which in this representation depends on v, phi, and t. Again, just to remind you that sort of each of these three variables can potentially become a clock for the other two. And then this is the kind of explicit form. So that's your Wheeler-DeWitt equation in the way you would always kind of derive it in these kind of quantum cosmology models. The nice thing about this model is that you can solve everything analytically, so not just the classical solutions, but also quantum solutions.
I have a question.
Yes.
Because like a priori factoring ordering ambiguities are not so obvious in the expression you have above. Because you just have a p squared v standing alone, and the v squared only appears with a phi. But then you do quantize basically pv squared into the second order derivative plus the first order one. So that comes from this requirement that you have the Laplacian on the Rindavitch.
That's right. Yes. Yes, indeed.
In these kind of coordinates?
Yes, that's right. That comes from the Rindler wedge metric. Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
It's true. So this is a choice, absolutely. So you could just do what you just said and basically say this first term becomes this and the second term becomes this and then
yeah,
this is
no, not naively right. I would have done that. So.
That's fine. And you might get a slightly different answer. I mean, we haven't studied this, so I can't tell you what you get. But of course, this is a higher order correction then, right? Because this is h bar squared, but only with one derivative. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, this is the type of correction you expect from ordering ambiguities, which of course are always present in these approaches.
Okay, and that is symmetric or self-adjoined or whatever. I mean,
yes, I'll come to that in a second. Exactly. So yeah. one of the reasons for doing this and using this kind of geometric ansatz where you say you have the box operator is that you think this box operator can be self-adjoined. You think you know how to turn it into a self-adjoint operator. Mm-hmm. I'll come to that on the next slide. The point I wanted to make here is that the nice thing about this model is that you can solve it analytically. So you can write down the explicit solutions that would probably still be true if this term wasn't there. And they are basically written in terms of these Bessel functions here. So you can expand in a basis. So of course, yeah, the natural thing is you assume a plane wave in phi and in t, and then you solve the remaining kind of one-dimensional problem, and it has these Bessel function solutions, which are given here. And I'll talk about these a little bit in the following, but yeah, the main point is that sort of analytic solutions exist. Now you want to specify an inner product and you want to define a clock. And there are the three different options, as I already said multiple times. So one option that you might prefer here is to choose this t variable as a clock, right? Because this is just linear in this kind of derivative here, first derivative. So this looks like a Schrodinger equation, right? You just want to move this thing to the right-hand side as I'm doing here. And then you get a kind of Schrodinger equation. And in fact, this is how I first came across this model. In fact, there were a few papers by Sean Gribb and Karim Debeau, which discussed this theory from quite a different angle, but certainly with that starting point where they basically wanted a type of Schrodinger equation. So that's the first option, and it seems quite natural. And then your quantum states would kind of you would think of them as time dependent in terms of this t variable, and you would define this kind of inner product at a fixed t, which is kind of this integral over the Rindler wedge. That's kind of continuation of Bianca's question here. So you have this kind of natural way of defining an inner product by using this metric on the Rindler wedge. I think there's a question, right?
Yes, Hank.
Yeah, sorry, I'm just wondering what's the boundary condition?
So at the moment, I didn't want to impose any, right? So these are just the general solutions.
Right.
But I'm gonna need a boundary condition in about 10 seconds.
Yeah. So I was wondering, the inner product sort of depends on regularity, right, of psi and phi.
Yes.
Yeah. So you sort of need the k, basically.
Mm-hmm. That's
so right. That's the boundary condition, right?
Sure, sure, sure. So once I have an inner product, of course, that you know, requiring that's finite, then we'll impose restrictions on the states.
Okay.
But the idea was to kind of first use the general solution. Start with an inner product and then see what that tells me about what solutions are allowed.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
Thanks for the question. The point is now that this is not automatically conserved under T evolution. So this operator is in fact not essentially self-adjoint. I mean, it would be if it was the box operator on the whole of Minkowski space, but now you restricted it to this Rindlow wedge. And in fact, you need to go to a subspace of allowed wave functions. And on this subspace, you can then define a self-adjoint extension of this operator. So this is quite a standard kind of problem that I guess some of you will have seen before and be familiar with. And in fact, it was discussed by these guys quite extensively in their papers. And one way of deriving this or understanding this is kind of just to go to a simpler one-dimensional problem. So again, this is kind of this ansatz that I showed you before, where kind of you just assume plane waves with respect to phi in this case. So then you can reduce basically from the Rindler wedge to an effectively one-dimensional problem. And there you would have to require that this operator is self-adjoined on the half line, so on the positive part of the real axis. And so this is kind of, you can think of this as a potential sort of in terms of a radial coordinate, which is sort of attractive and goes like 1/r². And if you've seen that kind of problem before, also there you need these boundary conditions. So this is not automatically a self-adjoint Hamiltonian. And so you have to impose some kind of boundary conditions. And kind of these boundary conditions are related to the fact that the classical solutions reach this boundary in finite time, right? As I showed you before, these solutions sort of have a singularity where V goes to zero at some finite time. And so in a sense, it makes sense that they have to be reflected there. So that's the result of this kind of analysis. If you start with this T time, you need these boundary conditions basically at the singularity. We work through the general solution here. So I just want to show you this sort of for the full glory of it. So if you require that this is a unitary theory, if you require that this is an inner product that is conserved under time evolution, then you have this sort of choice of subspace of solutions or choice of boundary condition, which if you're in this one-dimensional problem, this always involves one free parameter. So this is something you might be familiar with. So here the free parameter becomes a free function. And so this is of course very messy, but the point is just that here you have this free function, theta of k. So this theta of k is something that you have to specify, which kind of defines your choice of self-adjoint extension. So this is not unique. And in some sense, this corresponds to a kind of a phase shift when you do this reflection from the boundary. So this is something you have to put in. The point here is to stress that sort of instead of these kind of general linear combinations of Bessel functions that we had before, right? So here we had arbitrary linear combinations of these Bessel functions. Now you have a particular linear combination. So it's the real part of this Bessel function multiplied by this kind of phase here, right? And so there's always going to be all the modes that are allowed in your theory are some linear combination of ingoing and outgoing, right? You can't have something that only goes through V equals zero and is not reflected. So that's just the result of this boundary condition. For negative lambda, the story is much more complicated. So these are a bit like bound states. So only certain values of negative lambda are allowed. Again, the allowed values depend on this kind of free function here that you had to choose. You have this infinite sum here over all the possible values and so on and so forth. This is not going to be too important in what follows, but what is important is that the allowed states are now very much restricted by this boundary condition. So in particular, if you wanted to have a classical, if you wanted to follow the classical solution, right, which is just kind of collapsing into the singularity or only coming out of the singularity, that's not going to work in general because you will be reflected from this boundary.
Just to clarify, the new k, what you call the free function, this you have to fix as part of the theorem.
Yes, that's right.
Or as part of the inner product. But above, the free parameters in your solutions are capital B and capital A?
Yes, that's right.
Oh, okay, so that means you have still two physical degrees of freedom?
I mean, it's kind of...
Or do you effectively reduce even?
You're only left with half of the solutions, right? The original solutions. So these are the negative lambda solutions. These are the positive lambda solutions, right? So here only goes over positive values. And here I have these bound states.
But often I'm only left with half of the solution in quantum mechanics, no? So is that...
Absolutely.
That's not unusual.
Okay. That's true. Yeah, absolutely. So these Bessel functions, they're like plane waves, right? So you can think of them at least asymptotically near the singularity. You can think of them as an ingoing wave that sort of goes into the singularity and one that is coming out of the singularity. So these are two solutions that would be allowed classically. Initially, these are both solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Now I have these reflecting boundary conditions. So I only get this linear combination. So that is a restriction in that sense. Here, of course, the fact that these bound states, there's only one solution, that's of course quite common because of course, usually you have one that decays exponentially, one that blows up or something like this, and only one would be normalizable.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you. Right, I'm not going to show you these explicit solutions again. So this was just an example. And the reason why this is also messy is that basically these are now normalized modes, right? So the normalizability condition is basically the integral over a squared plus integral over b squared equals one. The point I wanted to get across is this reflecting boundary condition. So now if you use this phi clock, you want to use the scalar field as a clock, as we are used to in quantum cosmology. Again, you can rewrite your Wheeler-DeWitt equation in this form. So I've again just regrouped terms, and I've also multiplied by v squared. So here, if I multiply by v squared, I get rid of this. There's a v squared here, and here I can regroup these two terms into one. So I get this kind of expression here. So this looks a little bit like a Klein-Gordon type equation, where again, on the Rindler wedge, right? I'm kind of on a portion of Minkowski space. And I have this last piece, which I can in some sense think of as potential, sort of which is in quotation marks. Of course, it has a derivative here. But again, if I make this plane wave ansatz, then this would be a potential in some sense. So then the natural inner product to use for this type of equations is of this Klein-Gordon type. So now this has like derivatives in phi. This is defined at a particular kind of instant in phi time now. So it's an integral over the other variables. You have to worry about the fact that this is, you know, has to be redefined to be positive definite and so on. This is not something I want to focus on here, but you can do this by kind of redefining it in some clever way. But the point here is again, that this is not automatically conserved under this phi evolution. So again, this is not a unitary theory unless you impose boundary conditions. So mathematically, it's a very similar problem to the previous one, but the boundary conditions are now at infinity, right? So this is now kind of interesting. Again, you can rephrase this into this one-dimensional language by making this plane wave ansatz and so on. And then you realize that the self-adjointness problem you have to solve is now this. So you have a kind of, again, a kind of a 1D Hamiltonian with this kind of potential here. But now on the full real line, but this lambda can be arbitrary. So if lambda is negative, if lambda is positive, this is an attractive exponential potential, right? So this will kind of accelerate you towards infinity. And in fact, you will hit infinity in some finite time. So again, this is of course what we saw also in the classical theory, these cosmological solutions hit infinite volume in some finite time in this phi clock. So that's where you need the boundary condition. And the story is quite similar to what I had before. So I'm not going to show you the details again. I think I'm also running a bit late, but I just wanted to show this mathematically very similar problem, but now completely opposite conclusion. You need the boundary conditions now at infinity, not at zero. And you can define a third theory where V is the clock, again, by viewing this as a kind of Klein-Gordon equation. This is then interesting because this depends on V. So it's kind of a time-dependent kind of evolution problem. But there you find, in fact, that a very similar type of inner product is automatically conserved. So this theory is, in some sense, automatically unitary. And all these Bessel function solutions that I showed you before are basically allowed. They lead to a norm that is conserved, and there's no boundary condition that is needed. So all these three theories are very different in what they require on these states. So I kind of already explained what the reason for that is. So this maybe looked a bit technical, but the reason is that we already saw in the classical theory that these solutions terminate at some finite time, right? So in the T time, you have the Big Bang or the Big Crunch at some finite time. If I go into the phi time and my lambda is positive, then the universe actually reaches infinite volume in finite time because this clock is so weird, right? It kind of slows down infinitely as the universe expands. So I will already reach infinite volume at some finite value of this clock. So classically, we are used to this, as I said before, in GR, of course, we would say these are just funny coordinate choices, perhaps, especially this phi clock. But quantum mechanically, if we require that the theory is unitary, the solution cannot terminate. It obviously must continue. And so we have to have some kind of departure from the classical theory. So in some sense, this sounds quite obvious if you think about it in that way. But it seems to have these very interesting kind of consequences in quantum cosmology. The kind of sort of most general statement we found in the literature was this conjecture here, Gauthier and Desmarais in 83. They looked at this problem and they had a conjecture which says that unitary slow time quantum dynamics is always non-singular, while unitary fast time quantum dynamics inevitably leads to collapse. So what they mean by slow time and fast time is basically a slow time is a clock that only measures a finite amount of time until you hit the singularity. So the clock in some sense is slow. It only ticks kind of finite amount of times before the singularity, and a fast clock would be one that sort of goes to infinity at the singularity. And what they're saying is basically that because of this argument, in some sense, if you want your theory to be unitary, you have to resolve the singularity in this sense. Whereas if the clock takes infinitely long, then you can follow the classical solutions and you would end up in the singularity. And that's what we confirm here in this work. And we also extend this same argument to the situation where you reach infinity in finite time, where you have exactly the same kind of argument. Just some comments on previous work. I already mentioned Grip and Thibault. So this is kind of what got us started on this. They looked at this theory only with the T clock. And they found this kind of generic singularity resolution in the sense that the for any state, the volume is always bounded from below by some non-zero value, which depends on the state. So that's what they focused on. And we confirmed this in kind of this slightly different kind of language that we were using. Obviously compared this to the other clocks. This model, the same model with the kind of same Hamiltonian constraint, was studied by Boyovald and Halnan. So they used deparameterization for different clocks, and they had this effective approach, then a classical approach. And they say that sort of different clocks lead to different inequivalent results, which they basically attributed to different factor orderings. And if you go back a bit further, of course, here we have this lambda, which is an integration constant. So it's not a fundamental parameter. But of course, for each fixed value of this lambda constant, your theory looks like GR with a massless scalar field and a fixed value of the cosmological constant. And this was looked at for positive lambda by Pavlovsky and Ashtika in 2012. They used the phi clock in this Wheeler-DeWitt theory, and they found this recollapse of the universe at large volume, but no singularity resolution, which is basically what we found. So you get reflected from infinite volume, but there's no singularity resolution.
There is a question by Bianca.
I just wanted to ask whether that possibly connects to a simple argument, which is using the so-called physical Hamiltonian, which is a Hamiltonian if you do gauge fix, basically. Then if you do that with a volume time, you actually, in some sense, classically freeze the at least Big Bang singularity, for instance. Mm-hmm. And so this cannot be resolved quantum mechanically in any way. Mm-hmm. because you have a term which basically would be P phi squared divided by a classical parameter, which is V. So I don't know how it, like, how it works out with the other argument. Is that a simpler argument, or is it?
Yeah, I think that's a good argument.
Seems a bit more involved, so maybe.
Yeah.
How it works for the other clocks.
Mm-hmm. So, right. So that's true. So in the literature, of course, people focus on the question whether V goes to zero or not, right? Or whether there's some expectation value that stays away from zero or whatever. But of course, you can study all of the observables you can construct. So you can construct arbitrary relational observables, right? Phi of T or phi of V or whatever. And for all of these, you could ask similar questions, like, do they encounter, you know, the boundaries that they seem to have in the classical theory? Do they ever go to zero or to infinity and so on? And I think the type of argument you mentioned would at least naively seem to apply to any combination of dynamical variables, if I can express it in this relational sense. That's certainly something to look at, I guess. So we thought about this in the context of V as a time. That's basically the argument you mentioned, where indeed you say V is now in some sense no longer quantum. I can't define anymore sort of what is an expectation value of V and does it deviate from the classical solution and things like that. In the context of this conjecture here, the Gauthier and Desmarais conjecture, in some sense, it's for V, it's a bit trivial because V, you know, the points you are interested in are the boundaries of the range where the clock is defined, right? So in some sense, the clock goes from zero to infinity, which is the V clock. And these are the points where something interesting happens. So there's no notion of unitarity that goes beyond that. It's, you don't have one, obviously, right? So in that sense, there's no argument for why you should deviate from the classical behavior, also from this kind of general argument, if that makes sense.
Thanks.
Okay. So how much time do I have? I guess I have a few minutes.
6 minutes.
Okay. All right.
You had many questions, so you can continue a little bit more.
Great. I'm mostly done. I just wanted to show you some numerical stuff after making this point here. So of course, there are many choices, as we already discussed to some extent. There are these sort of factor ordering choices and also the inner product, which of course we say this is kind of the obvious choice, sort of for the Schrodinger type theory, you have the Schrodinger type inner product, and for the Klein-Gordon type theory, you have a Klein-Gordon type inner product. But of course, you can question whether there are other choices of inner product. And in fact, this is, of course, what was often done in the literature. And that's why people developed this approach of group averaging and Dirac quantization, which in some sense seems less ad hoc, because you can use the constraint to sort of define a physical inner product. So here I mentioned already in the beginning, there are these kind of recent results that are very exciting, where you can look at this group averaging construction. And the simplest way to do this, and in fact, the only way that I know how to do this explicitly, is if your Hamiltonian constraint is the form system plus clock. So it can be written as something that is the Hamiltonian of the clock, which doesn't couple to the system, plus the system. There will be other cases, and Bianca will probably know some cases where this can be done much more generally, but these are certainly the ones that are easiest to treat. So if you start with this constraint that we had in the beginning, which is this Willett-Witt equation here, of course, this is already of the form some stuff here that depends on V and phi and this kind of T Hamiltonian, right? So here the group averaging is essentially trivial and it leads to this kind of Schrodinger inner product that we use. So the conclusions would be exactly the same. If you wanted to use phi as a clock, the point is here, there's still some coupling between V and phi. So I would like to redefine the constraint. I would like to multiply this whole thing by V squared, as I already did, in fact, before. And then I would do the group averaging, but with respect to this modified constraint, which has been multiplied by V squared. And I can think of this, of course, as choosing a different lapse. And that's in fact where, in some sense, this comes from, right? One is the theory where the lapse is equal to one, and the other one is the theory where the lapse is equal to v squared. So the constraints look different. The group averaging constructions are not the same. They give you a different physical inner product. And if you look at the details of the arguments, you would, and if you demand that this constraint is self-adjoint, of course, that's important. So that would be the analog of the Hamiltonian being self-adjoint that we had before. You would get the same answers. So this does not help you because you really have to deal with two different constraints. They're not exactly the same constraint. So that would kind of address this objection. For the V clock, I don't really know how to do this through group averaging. So that's something maybe to ask later. I just want to show you some numerics here. So here we had all these general arguments, but just to illustrate a bit more what happens, we then looked at some numerics. So we did what people usually do in this approach, which is to fix some nice semi-classical state, some kind of Gaussian state, maybe far away from the singularity, and evolve and see what happens. And here you see the results for some choices of states here. So this is the T clock theory, right? V of T, the solid line, that's your classical solution. Here the classical solution ends in the Big Crunch. There's a new one here coming from the Big Bang. And you see that these expectation values here in the quantum theory, they follow very closely here the classical solution. And then here they start deviating a lot. So this is when your quantum fluctuations become large around the expectation value, which is of course related to the fact that your state now gets reflected here from V equals zero, right? So part of the state here is already going backwards again. And so the expectation values here stay away from zero. As I already told you earlier, this is kind of a specific illustration of this. Maybe what's interesting here is that these curves look different depending on which kind of parameters you choose for your state. So here in particular, this depends on the standard deviation. So everything else was kept fixed. The standard deviation, that kind of the variance in the Gaussian was changed, and then you get these kind of different curves. So in particular, this minimum value you see very explicitly is state dependent, but you see this reflection behavior here very nicely. What's perhaps more intriguing is that you also see this here for infinity when phi is the clock. So this is the log of V, just for illustration. Again, the solid line is the classical solution, diverges here and goes to infinity. And you look at the expectation values in these states, and you see again, this kind of reflection behavior. So this universe never reaches basically infinite volume, but only reaches some kind of maximum, and then gets reflected in some sense and becomes a contracting universe. And here further away, if you zoom out a little bit more, you would see again here very close agreement with the classical solution. Maybe to make the point even more drastically, you can compare two different variables for the same clock. So this is what we found very interesting here. So in the classical theory, as I told you before, V of T is monotonic. In each branch of the classical solutions, if lambda is positive. So here we often fix to lambda, we often restrict to lambda being positive because that's the most interesting case, right? That's where this crazy behavior happens where the universe goes to infinity at finite time. So that's also what we restrict to here. So if we use phi as a clock now, right, we can compare V of phi and T of phi, right? So we could do that in the classical theory. And we would see this monotonic relation here, right? So this is the classical solution, again, comes out of the Big Bang, just grows forever. And this one sort of comes from infinity, collapses, ends in the Big Crunch. This is always monotonic, but now if you compare these quantum expectation values, you see that this starts going backwards, right? So this T time here, as the universe kind of expands, starts turning around and suddenly going backwards. Goes through zero at this kind of turning point here. This is just out of symmetry. And then it merges eventually with this classical contracting branch. So this is something that's kind of, you can again see as the weird kind of quantum behavior where sort of this was classically a nice clock. Everything was monotonic, but now in terms of these quantum expectation values appears to go backwards. Perhaps the weirdest thing is that this happens when the universe is very large, right? So you think of this as a very low energy regime, and you wouldn't really expect crazy quantum effects to be there. But that's certainly what happens. And just as a last thing here, you can visualize this by these kind of conformal diagrams. So basically, there's kind of always this quantum region here, which is gray, which is what your quantum fluctuations are very large. And this is where you kind of glue two classical solutions together. So for the T clock, you have this solution here, which kind of contracts, and normally it would end in a singularity. And here you have one that comes out of the singularity, but now these are connected by this quantum region. And if phi is the clock, the opposite happens, right? You have this expanding branch, which is now connected to this contracting branch, again, via this kind of a region where quantum fluctuations are large, right? So this is always clear that sort of in these regions, the quantum expectation values deviate a lot from the classical solution because your fluctuations start becoming very large. Right, so I think that was kind of what I wanted to say. So here's some points of discussion, just the summary again of the main points. We required that these theories are all unitary. So we have three different choices of clocks. We require unitarity with respect to these clocks, and then the theories turn out to be very inequivalent. The crucial point is that you have classical solutions which terminate in some finite time, and then these require some reflecting boundary conditions, and that's when you deviate strongly from the classical theory. So this canonical quantization seems to not be covariant with respect to reparameterizations, in the sense that you can think of these three different theories as corresponding to different choices of Laplace function. In this case, you end up with these very different types of boundary conditions, even if you're using group averaging and Dirac quantization. So in a sense, there seems to be this clash here, which is illustrated in this model, between this requirement of unitarity and wanting some general covariance. And of course, this is something that was discussed in the literature by many people over many years. But in this model, this is particularly striking, perhaps, because you can calculate everything explicitly. One way out would be to say, well, maybe one choice of clock is more fundamental. Unitarity is not fundamental for all clocks, but maybe just for one preferred clock. So a natural requirement here, perhaps, would be to say that only the clock that measures proper time, where the lapse is equal to one, this is the physical time, and this is where we need unitarity and not for other kind of quantizations. This is, of course, one way out, perhaps potentially, but it would be clearly at odds with the usual kind of requirements of general covariance. Then, of course, what we did here is very much in the canonical quantization framework. So from a more abstract point of view, what you would like to maintain in your quantization is, of course, gauge invariance with respect to time reparameterizations. So in the path integral, for example, there are these frameworks like the BFV formalism, which have been used by people in quantum cosmology to define a kind of path integral that at least formally does not depend on the gauge choice. So it would be very interesting to compare with that and see if one can understand these results from that perspective. And then, of course, more generally, in quantum cosmology, we would actually like to see non-classical behavior, right? This is, in a sense, the point of using quantum cosmology. We would like to have a theory that deviates from the classical solution so that we can claim, for example, a resolution of the singularity. But of course, here it seems that, you know, these results might actually depend quite strongly on choices of clock and so on. And so that kind of leads to this general question of what do we do with that in terms of physical interpretation. Right, that was everything. So thanks very much for your attention.
Thanks, Stefan, for this very interesting talk. Okay, I see that there is a question by Bianca, but first, are there questions from students? Not for now. So, Bianca?
Sorry for asking so many questions. No, it's very interesting and a bit surprising, because there is a standard claim is that like Dirac quantization would not depend on a choice of clock. Mm-hmm. But here you say, well, to do something explicit like group averaging, I have to make a choice. Mm-hmm. Would you expect that to hold also more generally?
That's true. That's a very good question. So of course, indeed, if I can modify the group averaging procedure, I can replace it by something else, which is more covariant, I might get around these conclusions. Absolutely.
Yeah. Maybe if I can make a comment to the what I conjecture what happens in the path integral approach, because I'm also looking at that in a different context. I do believe that it, in the end, it also might show the same key, because path integral in the end is only a form of reaching. It might show the same ambiguity, because you have to, in this simple example, you have a bit of a choice of what measure you associate to the integral over the gauge orbits. And so typically that would be like dn, you know, the integral over your lapse, but you can redefine your lapse. And that leads to different measures you should choose, and they might then kind of come with the same thing, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, in some sense, some people say you can actually only derive it from a Hamiltonian quantization, and then it's just exponential IH, and then you see it actually quite simply as, again, redefining your N. But maybe it can also teach us if this BFV formalism, how to avoid it. I do think it might, the ambiguity might be hidden there, kind of. Mm-hmm.
That makes a lot of sense.
Okay. So your statement would be also that the kind of claims of singularity resolutions are clock dependent and are already physically determined how the clocks behave classically, like if it's a slow clock or a fast clock.
Yeah, so right. So that's actually in some sense the most interesting aspect, I guess, that indeed you can read out this behavior in some sense already from the classical theory. Of course, there's a long discussion of what do we mean by singularity resolution and so on. So you have to define it very clearly. But it seems quite clear that if you have these theories which allow solutions to terminate at finite time in your clock, then you need to do something if you want to have a unitary theory. So some kind of reflecting boundary condition seems inevitable. In this theory, you could say, I mean, this was of course what Grib and Thibault analyzed in their papers. You could say that this theory has a singularity resolving behavior if you're happy to work with this t time, then, you know, because the t clock is slow, you have to be reflected. So from that point of view, it would seem that you can maybe push this much more generally, and you could extend this to all kinds of systems. Whenever there's a clock which allows me to hit the singularity at finite time, I have to be reflected if I'm demanding unitarity. So the conjecture, if you want to make a conjecture out of this and claim that it's true generally, of course, it would have to apply in all kinds of other systems. Only that very few systems exist where this can actually be done analytically, and you can actually do the calculation. So that would be very interesting to look at other examples, of course.
Other questions? Yes, so one by Seth.
Hello, thank you, Stefan, for your nice talk. Can I interpret your work as suggesting that maybe there are models where you find that relational clocks are not physical, and that leads me to maybe like think about the question that like, does this happen in maybe in generic models? Basically, like, how physical is your model that you get these results from?
Mike? Thank you. That's a very general question, of course. I think, yeah, this depends on what you mean by physical, of course. So here, I'm trying to take the structure from the classical theory as far as I can. So if I have quantities that in the classical theory are good clocks, I would like to keep these as clocks in the quantum theory. And of course, if you know the 1 degree of freedom that you have chosen as a clock, in some sense, you know, by assumption, maintains that property of being a clock. But of course, there was this other result that I just showed you, which was then if you compare several quantities with each other that classically would all be good clocks for each other, basically, then mm-hmm. this will break down when you have these non-classical effects. So in some sense, I don't know. I mean, you can interpret this as saying that sort of these notions that, you know, are well-defined classically can break down in your quantum theory. But whether you call that physical or unphysical, I don't know. I mean, this is, I think I'm quite agnostic on that. I would like to understand better sort of how general these results are.
Okay, yeah, I see.
That makes sense.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? I would also have a couple of basic questions. So one thing that I was wondering is the following. So in the context of cosmology, in particular in mini superspace, it is in a sense more straightforward to redefine time, so to find the time reparametrization, so to define clocks. But beyond the mini superspace formalism, how would you do that? So because for instance, in this case, you had two possibilities. So with respect to the standard time t, you used the function small v that is defined with respect to the scale factor. So of course, this comes from the mini superspace, and then you had the scalar field. So in a sense, it is a simplification because that comes from having the mini superspace ansatz and from having a scalar field and not something more complicated like a vector field that could probably make the time reparametrization and the redefinition of time more involved. So I was wondering how this would work in general. That of course it is difficult, but so I was wondering if this possibility of redefining the time and to define clocks is limited to a situation where we can really do a calculation, or it is something that more generally conceptually can be
stable. So this question of relational clocks is of course much more general. It applies to any gravitational theory, any diffeomorphism invariant theory. And there are many models which have been proposed in the literature of kind of matter clocks that or also spatial coordinates, in fact, defined by matter fields. So there are these very popular dust models, Brown-Kukach dust and so on, which are, you know, space-time covariant theories of matter fields that are designed in such a way that these matter degrees of freedom can serve as coordinates. So of course they are, again, not necessarily very physical. So I don't know if you are very realistic, I guess. So that depends on that, well, that's part of the question. But from the conceptual point of view, this is not restricted to mini superspace. And this is a very general question of where your clocks and where your relational coordinates come from in some sense. And people have in fact constructed sort of quantum theories also outside of mini superspace. So there are, for example, these dust models that have been applied to LQG, you know, in principle also with the inhomogeneous degrees of freedom, where mm-hmm. this dust is supposed to be a standard of time that somehow a clock, yeah, the global standard of time, so to speak. So of course the question is whether you can find a model where there are different choices of clock that can be compared and you could ask the same questions of whether things are equivalent or not. So the literature that I'm aware of, people, you know, add these fields for the, in order for them to be clocks, and then, you know, use that to define a theory. And then there's a notion of unitarity and time evolution just restricted to that. I'm not sure I've seen a study which compares different clocks within the same theory. And of course, that's much harder. But in principle, there's no obstruction from the conceptual point of view, at least not any that I can see.
Okay, I see. But in any case, there would be the possibility to define clocks using matter fields that we know. Mm-hmm. I mean, because of course, from the point of view of a theoretical physicist, it is useful to have a specific type of field that can be used to as a clock, for instance. But if it is not something that then is in the theory, one cannot really just add it, I guess.
Yes, I agree with that, of course. Yeah, in a general setting, if you're presented with a particular theory that you would like to understand, you have no reason to expect that this theory has a degree of freedom, which is a global clock. I mean, these are, in some sense, these are designed to be tractable. And so in general, of course, you have to attack that problem from a very different angle. And you have to think about ways of defining dynamics that aren't dependent on global clocks. And yeah, so I certainly agree with that.
Okay, good. Thanks. Are there other questions? Okay, so if not, let's thank again Stefan.
Thank you.
And see you all next time. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thanks for coming. Bye.